Hello and welcome back to the Romaniacs Bunker, which, if you believe the ever sweatier Dominic Raab, resembles an expensive advertising agency where a small but senior group of politicians gather to subvert the referendum and foil the will of the people. Dominic is welcome to visit our unventilated subterranean lair in elitist Soho, where he will doubtless be shocked at the lack of executive armchairs and will probably perspire himself down to the size of a peanut. Whatever, I'm Andrew Harrison and I've got two of our regulars with me this week. Naomi Smith is the Chief Operating Officer of Best for Britain, here in personal capacity, of course. And she's enjoying the throes of conference season as she battles for people's votes. Hello, Naomi. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. I sort of feel like I do perform some surgery and operations on people from time to time in my role.
How was the Labour conference? Because you haven't been on since that. Where you actually managed to shift policy imperceptibly by mind control of Keir Starmer.
Well, I have to give a massive shout out to the group Another Europe is Possible. Look them up if you haven't heard of them. They did an absolutely Herculean effort in getting the constituency Labour parties across the country to pass resolutions ahead of that conference. So I think they accounted for about 70 of those. They worked their absolute socks off. So absolute credit to them for helping to shift Jeremy Corbyn to where we almost need him to be, getting ever closer.
I would ask you about the Conservative conference, but of course, Best for Britain were banned from the conference, only because you're sort of visiting. How did your fringe event with Philip Lee go?
It went brilliantly. We had this amazing person from the audience stand up and talk about how they are a veteran. They were wounded in Northern Ireland. And what would, you know, leavers say to him about, you know, did his friends get injured in vain? And he got injured in vain for the Good Friday Agreement to come to fruition, only to be torn up by them. So it was a really impassioned fringe meeting. It was excellent. So yeah, despite being banned, we had a great event.
I saw that Philip Lee remarked that it's rather exciting to be at an event that's been banned. It's like the song Relax, when you want to remain.
Or when you want to... Exotic Spresum.
Yes, Spresum, yes. Conservatives for People's Vote had to speak on the fringe, so it's like, no, 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 I can't hear you now, basically government policy.
Apparently so, or certainly Conservative voice policy.
Yes. Also with us is political commentator, actor, singer, columnist, and the best thing to come out of Greece since the concept of democracy itself, as well as Vangelis, Alex Andreou. Hello, Alex, welcome back to the show. And
Hello.
The UK, you had a lovely week at home in Mykonos, where you have been avoiding Cyclone Xenophon, like me.
Yes, Medicane Zorba.
Medicane Zorba, smashing all the plates. I noticed you had a fun week spotting Twitter accounts that are suddenly saying, I voted Remain, but now I'd vote Leave. Where are they coming from?
You have a strange idea of fun. I don't know. And I'm not saying there aren't people who have switched from Remain to Leave, because obviously, statistically, there are. We've seen that in the polls. But the numbers on Twitter, especially in the last 2 weeks, don't seem representative of that sort of sample. So I notice a pattern of a lot of accounts that were opened between 2011 and 2013, have been very, very quiet for many years, have tweeted nothing about Brexit before the vote, very little since. And suddenly in the last sort of month, they're all, I voted Remain, but now... I'm so upset by how appallingly Theresa May has been treated that I fully back a hard Brexit and bombing Paris.
Yeah. Well, friend of the podcast, Rob Fitzpatrick, tweeted, I voted Remain, but having seen the way the EU has humiliated our government and ignored the 17.4 million people who voted to leave the EU, I would vote Remain again, and we'll do it again the time after. Speaking of voters who've changed their minds, this week's special guests are our favourite people in the whole world, former Leave voters who've changed their minds. Yay! And are now backing Remain. Emma Hookey and Hugh Norris are members of Remainer Now, the group for people who switched their support to Remain with the inspiring slogan, It's OK to Change Your Mind. Hugh is an IT project director from Wiltshire. He's worked in Europe and says he's never felt more European. Emma is from Southend, and you have a background in healthcare and stuff. I feel like I'm introducing a game show here. IT project director from Wiltshire.
So what's the prize?
The prize.
We know the prize. We know the prize.
Yeah. European Union.
That's the prize. So there's more.
Or dusty bin.
Or dusty bin, yes. Or the speedboat. There will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 self-righteous gits like us who need no repentance. So welcome to the show.
Thank you for your
hard work. We're going to talk about your personal journeys in detail a little bit later in the show. Emma, was there something in particular that tipped you over from supporting Leave to coming back to Remain, to the warm arms?
I was very 50-50 during the run-up to the referendum anyway. To be honest, there was a lot of hearsay for me from lots of relatives and in the community. And there was a lot of mysticisms around as well. I felt very scared, to be honest, by the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I just very much knew I didn't want to make the wrong choice. And, of course, I did that anyway. typical of me. I think certainly, I'm really guiltily going to admit, I know that for me there was NHS money. Mm-hmm. I've got two very disabled children. And way in the past, I used to work for the NHS. So only for a couple of years, though. And to me, that was something I did want to protect for all of us. And I also believed Mr. Hannan when he said that we would be staying in the single market. So I thought that would actually mean that a lot of people would be secure. So for all of this to have happened, I really am sorry. And I want to do more than say sorry. I want to help protect everyone's rights. I never wanted anybody's rights affected because of my choice.
That's interesting because a lot of people have pointed out that it doesn't reflect badly on people who voted to leave if they believed what they were told. What they believed was that politicians are generally trustworthy people who will tell you the truth. So if they say to you, don't worry, we're not leaving the single market, then you could bank that. And it turned out to be the most egregious lie you could possibly...
Among many.
Among many, yes.
I truthfully felt that with MEPs as well, because some people have gone to me and said, why would you believe a lowly MEP? And I thought, how could you? Surely people working within the European Parliament, wouldn't you count them as high, if not more, for their experience?
And it wasn't just MEPs anyway. Everybody was talking about Norway and dot, dot, dot. And,
And that suddenly changed as well. They can change their minds, but we can't. I don't get that.
Yeah. Hugh, was there a particular thing that changed your mind, that tipped your opinion?
What, from Leave to Remain, you mean?
Yeah.
It was the point where essentially people's rights were being affected. So as soon as I realised, oh, hang on a minute, are you saying people aren't welcome here anymore? Because again, similar to Emma, I thought we'd be talking still about some kind of Norway thing and there was a chance to maybe do even more trade. So I felt I was voting for more, not less. Mm. When that was interpreted as, oh, we're coming out of everything, and on a human level, I realised, wow, this is affecting real people and real people's lives. They're suddenly feeling like they're not welcome anymore and they don't actually know whether they can stay. As soon as I saw that interpretation of the vote, that was where I thought, hang on a minute, that was never discussed, and that was not from as far as I'm concerned. So that was the bit where I thought, hang on, what are they doing here? And then the more it unraveled and the more I found out, it reinforced the switch.
In one of the circulators I got through my door from my MP, Sir Amos, someone who I do hold in high regards.
This is David Amos, yeah?
Yeah. Hmm. One of the points he made was that there would actually be fairer immigration.
Right.
And I don't see that happening. I appreciate that is out of his hands. But that is not what's happening.
I think we're going to be talking about that in a fair bit of detail later in the show. I'm going to be talking more to Hugh and Emma from Remainer now later. About also how you too can persuade Leaver friends and relatives and people on the fence to get behind the people's vote. Also, we've got all the fun and games of the Tory conference. Yes, ABBA are ruined forever by Theresa May's dancing. Who wins the most objectionable rabble-rouser? Which of Theresa May's announcements on trade and immigration will bear any relationship to reality? And, of course, the best of the lot, Festival of Britain 2022.
Festival of Brexit.
The Festival of Brexit. Celebrating
Festering of Britain.
The Festering of Britain.
The Festering of Britain.
Celebrating the Union, and definitely not a big old DUP rave for Arlene Foster to celebrate the centenary of the partition of Ireland. I've just discovered that the year 2022 is when the movie Soylent Green takes place. So this is very apposite. I think the food concessions are going to be great. This burger tastes a bit pensionary.
Brexit means plankton.
Brexit means plankton. Hang on, you're a vegan. You should be perfectly happy with this.
There'll be Brexit burgers.
Brexit burgers. All this and all after these important words from Alex.
Firstly, the People's Vote March in London is coming up on Saturday, 20th of October. Autumn is crunch time for Brexit. This will be the most important protest march of our generation, and it's our biggest and best chance to ensure that the overwhelming groundswell for a final say vote cannot be ignored. So make sure you're there. We will be. Of course, banners maketh the march, and we all know that Remainers have the best sense of humour. So if you've got a smart slogan that you want to share, or you need ideas for your own banner, use the hashtag PeoplesVoteBanners on Twitter. It'll help inspire your fellow protesters, and we'll choose our favourite as the official Remainiacs banner for the march and send the winner a T-shirt too. That's hashtag PeoplesVoteBanners on Twitter. Secondly, we're taking the Romaniacs live show on the road. On Wednesday, November the 7th, we'll be at the Stroud Book Festival in lovely Gloucestershire. Rose Taylor, Ian Dunn, Dorian Linsky and I will be discussing whatever terrible state Brexit has reached by then and possibly stocking up on valuable emergency foodstuffs from the area's many excellent farm shops and local producers. Also, on a personal note, I am single and will be drunk afterwards. Tickets are going fast. Get yours at stroudbookfestival.org.uk and we will see you there.
Thank you, Alex, for that exciting proposition to the listenership there. Now, the country is at a crossroads. Where better to start for the sets to start falling apart than Birmingham? Ding, 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 ding. It's the Brexit news. First up, we'd really, really hope to get through the week without having to mention Boris Johnson. What were we thinking? In true statesmanlike style, the fraudulent fatberg managed to make the moment of his country's maximum crisis all about what's really important, himself and his leadership ambitions. Having entered the Conservative conference in a massive orchestrated scrum through the front door, although back door entrances are available for those not trying to make themselves look like a cross between an overweight Harry Styles and Donald Trump, Johnson proceeded to say that Chequers was not democracy and effectively claimed that Theresa May was a traitor, selling Britain out to a foreign power. Our own Ian Dunt tweeted that Remainers and people's votes should be ecstatic at this, Johnson essentially promising to vote against May's deal if it resembles Chequers, in which case it's no deal or remain. Naomi, Ian succinctly described the speech as fucking mental. Was there anything to Boris Johnson's speech except make me leader, it's my turn, but I don't want to actually do any work?
Come on, it was him giving the party faithful exactly what they wanted, spoon-feeding them, with the Kool-Aid, this sort of fawning audience that have queued up for hours and hours and hours to get in and see him. It was pompous, it was self-aggrandising, it was all of the things that we know Boris Johnson loves to do to position himself as a future leader. And he stood there criticising Chequers and criticising the backstop, which are all things that he signed up to, even if only for a short while.
Exactly.
And I think Ian is absolutely right to point out the craziness of Boris Johnson's logic. But I'm not sure that I agree with him that this is really good news for people's vote. Because that was one of the other things that Ian was saying, was that basically what it sounded like the speech was intended to do is to prove that the hard right of the Tories are not going to vote for Chequers, that they are going to chuck Chequers. And I'm afraid for me as a campaigner, that just feels too good to be true.
Right.
You know, if the Tory party are going to split on this in any significant number, then that would just be absolutely, you know, the most gifted thing for the Remain movement. And so I don't want us to be complacent. I still probably think that while Boris Johnson himself and potentially Rees-Mogg might vote against Theresa May, I suspect the majority of Conservative MPs on that wing of the party would not be able to, you know, bring themselves to do it because they know that it would just gift too much to the other side.
The speech was naturally a Woolworths pick and mix of lies and bullshit, but one particular tasty bit was he claimed that May could be prosecuted under a 14th century law, saying that no foreign court or government shall have jurisdiction in this country. This is apart from the obvious idiocy of it, it was immediately pointed out that this law had been repealed in 1967. So Captain Erudite, Captain I know the annals of, you know, I can recite the Magna Carta backwards, he's just pulling it out of his ear.
And, you know, this is the man that recited an imperial poem when he was in Myanmar. You know, he's just gaff prone and doesn't care, and it doesn't hurt him with his core audience, which at the moment
are
the voters.
I thought it was quite a shit speech, actually.
By his
not in a partisan way, not in a sort of I hate hard Brexit sort of way, but I thought by his standards, because he's a good orator, I thought it was de-energised. I thought he looked tired and his heart wasn't in it. It was really strange to see.
That was pretty true of the entire conference from what I could see. It looked small and it looked really lacking in energy, even for the Conservatives.
It just seemed to me that he's a man who feels the hand of history on his shoulder and bottled it, actually, at the last minute. That's what it felt like. And what's interesting is that all the commentators coming out of the speech had basically that assessment, including the BBC's political analyst that was there. And by 6 o'clock that evening, it had merged into this game-changing moment that everyone sort of, rose to applaud. And that just wasn't the atmosphere at the time. So I don't know why the narrative shaped, I suspect because he has a lot of friends in the media, that's why the narrative shaped in that way. But at the time, everyone was basically good fringe speech, but quite underwhelming as a bid to be the next prime minister.
It was like one of those stages at Glastonbury where a kind of like a reformed punk band with only one original member was sort of doing its hits. And, you know, and
you
really
felt
excited.
Was opening for someone else.
But the audience always gets really excited because it reminds them of when they were young and when they were having fun, you know. Emma and Hugh, you're the sensible middle of the road people. You're on our side of the fence now, but you know, by rights, you ought to be in play for this kind of a pitch from a supposedly, you know, country uniting person. How did the speech go over with you? How did Boris Johnson's latest?
Well, I watched it, and I have to say, even prior to the referendum, watching all the debates and the documentaries, and I watched the big debate the night before, you know, and I do think in hindsight, his oratory and, you know, he's a good speaker. Does tingle you? You know, he knows how to press buttons emotionally, and that all went into the pot as well. And it was the night before the vote and everything. Mm. So I watched this one, and I have to say I'm bored. I'm actually bored of him. That was my overriding. I thought I'll watch it anyway because of this. But I'm watching it with a different lens. I'm not watching it with the pomp and the celebrity and everything. I'm watching it waiting for detail and waiting for policy and waiting for what would you do, and there is nothing. So actually, I find him boring now, and I think I'd be surprised if I'm alone in as part of me switching my view on Brexit. I can't believe there aren't many, many more people out there thinking this is just a one trick. You know, you're a good speaker and you're a good entertainer, but there's no way, you know, you could be in charge of anything serious.
He had one little bit in there about we need to build a lot more houses, which coming from him simply isn't credible because he was mayor of London for 8 years. And in that time, London built less than half the number of homes. The London Assembly's own plan said it needed to do in order to keep pace with demand. Yeah. So, you know, he has never delivered.
But it's a pick and mix. And for some reason, media seems to let him get away with it. So, you know, we were sort of talking earlier today about the fact that, you know, if we remember not that long ago, he was widely derided from not necessarily political parties, but positions as one of the worst foreign secretaries ever. It seems to be forgotten now because he's back and he's got a funny speech and some good lines. Guys, let's actually seriously look at this, because why do we have this selective amnesia when people are good entertainers?
As I said the other day, rarely does a single person hold the definitive answer to something. But if you want to ask the question, would Boris make a more effective international negotiator, you only need to ask Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe. She can answer that question.
I was going to ask the panel who was the most odious individual at conference, but Boris Johnson was clearly always going to snatch it. However, what do we think of Jeremy Hunt comparing the EU to a Soviet prison?
Disgusted. Absolutely disgusted. I know he then later on, evidently when he was having dinner with people, he then said, oh no, that I didn't actually say that, though it is on YouTube and people did see it. Absolutely appalled. I would like an apology. Even if it was unintentional, surely there should be some sympathy for those that were affected.
And it's not really tenable for the Prime Minister to make a kind of keynote speech, or rather her closing speech, about openness and, you know, welcoming the right kind of immigrants, when she has sanctioned her own foreign minister making this, you know, offensively ahistoric, foolish, you know, rabble-rousing bit of gaslighting, and for it to be welcomed, obviously, with rapturous applause from the Brexit press. I thought it was truly nauseating, actually.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, this is at a time when we're supposed to be forging closer links with countries all around the world, and this is the person that's meant to be doing that on our behalf as Foreign Secretary. And, you know, it is disgusting. The EU has provided safe haven for many countries that were formerly under Soviet control. It has helped to bring democracy and human rights to those countries. And, you know, let's not forget, this is the guy who couldn't remember if his wife was Chinese or Japanese. So maybe he actually meant to compare the EU to a suffragette mission, not a Soviet prison, and it just sounds a bit the same and you got it a bit wrong.
When I said suffering, I meant suffragette.
Yeah.
And as someone who has a Chinese husband, it was not a very sensible comparison to have done. I appreciate you're in a foreign country, you must feel jet lag and all those things. But is not the best comparison to do in China.
No,
absolutely not.
I did particularly enjoy Priti Patel going on about the central tenets of conservatism.
And
well, we're all tenants because we can't afford to buy.
And the very tenants of Chequers.
The tenants.
She said several times, the very tenants of Chequers.
Well,
I thought, has it gotten to that?
Temporary.
Has Brexit got us to that? Yes. Do we need
super
to
tenants.
Rent out Chequers now to make
temporary residency? Meet? Also, special shout out to Philip Hammond, who said blockchain will solve the Irish border. £100 says he does not know what blockchain is. H blockchain, more like I think. I mean, I'm old. I'm ancient. And this felt to me like the dying days of Thatcherism, when you had the very dregs of talent left. Mm. No ideas. The very worst people. And open contempt for anybody but the activists in the room. Nobody else mattered. That crashed on the rocks of the poll tax. And I really don't know if it's going to crash on the rocks of a people's vote.
I just wanted to mention Dr. Lee.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he?
That was one thing that I felt. And also it just showed, because there are some amazing conservatives out there. And to me, it was just that nice little reminder, but what a shame it's so marginalised.
Yeah.
And
he's so credible because he's a doctor as well. And when we do, you know, testing on messengers with voters and who they actually are prepared to listen to, and medics are one of the few professions left that aren't utterly disgraced and disbelieved and the rest of it. And he does this very good line where he says, you know, as a medic, I have to get the informed consent of a patient before I can do a procedure. And I am in absolute dereliction of my duties if I do not do that. And I do not believe that the electorate in 2016 voted with sufficient information to be able to give their consent. Yeah. And that is why we need to go back to them. And it's
but
such
you know
a
what
great
happens
line
then?
For him
if
to say.
If you don't like what your doctor tells you, get a second opinion. We can get a second opinion.
But interestingly, Sarah Wollaston, who's also
a former medic,
I think she still does the odd days in A&E, she uses a very similar comparison. Mm. She says that you can't get consent to amputate a toe and then 2 years later say that use that to take off the whole leg without asking the patient again, is that all right with you?
But it's strange how, I don't know what's behind it or whatever, but whether it's media or what, I'm not sure, but it's strange how anybody with a level head, I would suggest, would agree with the idea of informed consent. And you think of any other decision you make in life, should I go for this job, should I buy that house, should I take this car, do we go to there on holiday or here to holiday? You get, you know, you make an initial decision, you get the facts, and they say, and you might change your view. Why not here? I just don't get the lack
tell
of
you what,
sense.
The Brexit compensation payments in future are going to make PPI look like very small. Emma?
I just wondered if you felt as well, a little bit when we were talking about Boris Johnson, do you feel in a way that it was like a lovely distraction technique, especially as freedom of movement's been taken away and you suddenly before had all these lovely pictures of him going through a wheat field and I'm like, here we are, it's all gearing up the stage for a Boris Boris performance. Mm-hmm. No disrespect.
I don't know if it's intentional.
Him.
I don't
it
know if
feels
it's intentional,
like it,
but it certainly has that effect. So what I mean, I don't know if it's intentional on his part. Obviously it's intentional, but what I'm saying is I don't know if it's coordinated, but it certainly has that effect, because what's happened is that effectively we're all now talking about the choice between no deal and Chequers as if there are no other options, if all other options have disappeared. The idea of EFTA, of a Norway-type deal, of a Swiss-type deal, of remaining...
Or staying in with our lovely current deal.
Well, as if those are no longer options for the country, only the thing Boris says versus the thing May says. And so it's been very effective in moving that debate in that direction.
I just looked at him in that field of wheat and thought, where is an out-of-control combine harvester? When you anyway, let's move on. Let's have some policy. Who remembers policy? I remember policy. Having talked tough since Salzburg about how it's up to the EU to put something on the table to break the impasse, it seems that Theresa May is ready for the inevitable climb down. The Times reported on Monday that she's about to make a significant concession to the EU by limiting Britain's ability to strike free trade deals after Brexit. We'd stay tied to EU customs rules on goods after transition, but not on services yet, in an effort to unblock the deal on the Irish backstop. The concession is likely to enrage Brexiteers, said the paper, who will claim that it amounts to staying in a partial customs union indefinitely. Absolutely fine by me. Meanwhile, with dreary inevitability, the Prime Minister finally made official her familiar stuff about immigration. EU citizens will no longer get priority to live and work in Britain in a move that, quotes, ends freedom of movement once and for all, as if that's a good thing. And there will be an aggressive demarcation on so-called unskilled workers, entirely unsupported by the government's own research, with unskilled apparently meaning those earning less than £50,000 a year. So, listeners, pack your bags. Most of us are earning less than that. Get going. Naomi, talk about this trade climb down first. How likely is it to happen, do we think?
I think it's pretty likely. She came away from Salzburg utterly humiliated. You know, that was a pretty embarrassing time for her and all at number 10. And I suspect there were some very heated discussions happening there. And I think that this trade climb down will probably form part of a new look at how goods cross the Irish border. And I think that they're probably going to come up with some kind of new solution that will be between Maxfac and Chequers, where she's going to try and convince the DUP that Northern Ireland isn't being treated differently because you won't actually be able to see the checking being done because they're going to come up with some kind of electronic checking. So whether that's unicorns and fairies and little leprechauns doing the checking of invisible goods so it's not seen or not, I don't know. But I think what I suspect, and you heard it here first, unless the government announced it tomorrow before this podcast comes out, but I suspect this is all part of this trade climb down, and the new Irish border thing is going to come out of number 10 in the next few days. And I think it's basically her challenge back to the EU to say, look, we've made even more compromise. It really is your move now.
So it's half Maxfac and it's half Chequers, which makes it Maxfuckers. You heard that first. We're having that one. We own that one. Emma and Hugh, how do you think a utterly humiliating climb down, which of course we knew was absolutely inevitable, how is this going to... I mean, you've got friends and family who are still committed leavers. How's it going to go down with your old mates in Southend and Devizes?
Well, some of my friends, the Remainers, a lot of them are still leavers. Mm. And a lot of them have just sort of very despondent from it and just gone, it'll be okay. Just leave them to it. Doesn't matter. And I've gone, what about the Good Friday Agreement? What about peace for Ireland, you know? And thinking about Northern Ireland and Ireland and how things will go. No answer. No response. They've just gone, oh, we're sure it will be okay. We were told it would be okay.
Yeah. Mm. Again, it's the consequences of a fairly, you know, stable political system that we've had for decades where you generally can trust politicians. And suddenly we find that we can't. Hugh, how about, you know, your old mates, what would they be saying?
Well,
about it?
I'd say the majority of them have actually changed to remain, although they're not ready to say that.
Yeah. And they may never be ready to say that.
Yeah, and that's fine. But, you know, when we've had the discussions of, you know, but what if there was a vote and you know, the privacy of the polling booth, they know that they would switch. Yeah. But they're not, you know, they wouldn't sort of, you know, these are quite tricky conversations.
Come on a podcast and say it.
Exactly. It took me a while. But the ones who haven't are sort of so disinterested. And not, this isn't a criticism, just a fact. They're so disinterested in any kind of detail. It's 2 years on, as Anna Soubry says, people are just fed up with it.
Yeah. And we're fed up with it. You know, we do a weekly podcast about it.
Yeah, well, you know. Yeah. But the ones who are still saying that there's either pride in the way or they just totally switched off from it. They've just had enough and just go sort it out when they just want to get on with it.
It is on this issue where I would probably tend to have, you know, quite a bit of overlap and agreement with hardcore leavers on what this would be, is effectively this vassal statism. You know, this would be awful to be totally locked out from any of the decision-making processes, still having to pay into the budget, being absolute rule takers. You know, that is not more control. No. That is not more sovereignty.
But this is the...
And I think that, you know, that's your original point, yeah. Andrew, is that this, who does this please?
The moral of this is there was never going to be more control.
No. I don't know. There could... The problem is that I think the proposition that leavers are putting out there is still very attractive at a basic emotional level. Yeah. And I don't think we as a movement have began to cope with that, because actually when you tell people, don't listen to the naysayers, we're strong, we can make it, everyone wants to believe that. No one wants to accept that, you know, as a nation we are codependent, that as a nation we need international cooperation. Everyone wants to believe the idea that we're, you know, we can be strong and independent instantly and with no pain. And so you start from a position where, because people want to believe you, it's easier for them to believe you.
Moving on to the immigration stuff. Which was, there was something genuinely nauseating in the glee with which he said this ends freedom of movement once and for all, as if the entire country has agreed that freedom of movement is this kind of scourge.
As if it only applied to foreigners.
Yes,
basically.
It's only freedom of movement for them. Yeah. Johnny Foreigner, yeah, yeah, come on, we can go back. Hang on a minute. But hold up, Theresa.
As
where
if
are we
she weren't
to
announcing the most catastrophic loss of rights for citizens of this country in 50 years.
Yeah, I can't imagine, I can't remember a time when a prime minister has so enthusiastically announced the removal of a load of rights
without a war.
People. Yeah,
without a war.
Yeah. But again, isn't that, you know, it's why is there no huge pushback in a public way from the public? And part of that is because in my view anyway, part of that is because it's not been properly explained. So as an example, long time ago, I saw a live streamed debate, and there was a German ambassador who she used they don't use the same term. They say it's freedom of labour, free movement of labour. Mm-hmm. So it just changes the tone of the discussion.
Yeah.
And secondly, the freedom of movement thing, whenever it's in the media, on TV or whatever, it's only discussed in one direction. So when you say, but what about, you know, the British citizens and they're going to lose
the
this right.
Because the Brits abroad are expats.
You know.
Yeah, but
they're not migrants.
Nobody seriously challenges the reply that, well, what do you want to go abroad for? Because nobody wants to be seen as the person championing the supposedly, you know, towering elitist ideal that you might want to go to university in a foreign country. Mm. That kind of thing. Emma?
Also, I'm just thinking about people in our communities, near and far. Because to me, Brexit is personal. That's to me. We're not talking about people's stories. I highly commend anybody to read In Limbo or In Limbo 2.
Yeah.
Because you realise these are people's lives from every area, British and Europe, the 3 million, all in between. There are so many people affected by this directly and indirectly.
Mm.
And I wish we could hear their voice more. Mm. I think those are the important things, because I feel they're being marginalised. I want to ensure they
you're
are heard
totally
and
right
being
on
able
the,
to say.
Because when you actually poll voters on immigration, if the headline is, yes, I think immigration is bad, and you then go into the next question, you ask them, which immigrants are bad? Do you mean international students? No, of course I don't. Do you mean healthcare professionals in the NHS? No, of course I don't. Do you mean your child's French teacher? No, of course I don't. Yeah. And actually, by the end of it, they actually are not opposed to immigrants.
I don't care also what job people have. I mean, to me, these are people in our communities, they're family and friends. I'm not going to worry about your label. You are you.
And we're richer for it.
I value you. I want you. Yeah. I've never wanted people
as
to
the,
feel
as
it's
the
not their
immigrant
home.
In
it
the
is
room,
our home.
If I may say, it's also a false distinction, completely false distinction. I came to this country at age 19 and I did unskilled work.
That wasn't very long ago, listeners.
That wasn't very long ago.
25
But I did unskilled work to start with. You know, I wouldn't call it that, but I worked in a hotel reception. That's what I did. So I could improve my English, so I could learn the lay of the city, learn how to use transport. I did that for a few months, you know, to acclimatize myself. I then went to law school and in order to support myself did unskilled work again, working behind the bar in the evening.
Mm.
You know, but then I graduated to a higher paying job. And that's what migrants do on the whole. They don't come here and set up their own business on day one.
The point is that's what everybody
does.
I was going
to
say, that's what
to come as ready-made. Exactly.
Yeah.
You can't expect them to come as ready-made heart surgeons. Mm. You know, they may come as people who work in a bar while going to university and then eventually become someone who contributes huge amounts. And the point is that on the whole, they do contribute. EU migrants are net contributors. Mm. I mean, that's the numbers.
Yeah, but I mean, that's we've had it demonstrated last week with the Migration Advisory Committee, which has been simply, you know, tossed to the side by the announcements of this conference. People, it's true, but people don't want to hear it. Emma,
Well, I'm just thinking as well. It's just you learn so much more from people, not just from one particular area.
Yeah. Mm.
When you hear about where people are from, it opens up a whole world for everyone as well, wherever they're working, wherever they are. And that's healthy for everyone.
It's a cultural enriching.
It's one of the things
monetary.
I love about us. Yeah. We're a storytelling nation. That's one of the things we should love. And the fact that we've got wonderful people near and far coming,
But if the idea persists that this is a zero-sum game, then it doesn't work. There was a vox pop from a woman in Dudley on the BBC yesterday, I think, and she was saying, well, I see, you know, I see British people who are homeless in the market, because she had a stall in the market, and, you know, and they have no place to stay and they're sleeping rough. And then I see the foreigners and they're nicely dressed and... You know, so the idea is that one is a trade-off for the other.
Yeah, there was a and part of lovely coats be looking, which they took.
Exactly,
yes.
As if, you know, as if you come in as an immigrant and, you know, someone at the border gives you a lovely sari to wear, as opposed to, you know, someone from this country who's being given no help. And so unless we attack that idea that it's not a zero-sum game, that services are elastic, this is a key point. I keep saying this to people. The idea that, you know, the idea that there will be more space at your local GP for you to get an appointment if you got rid of all immigrants is a lie, because that immigrant partly funds those services, and those services are elastic. And if you get rid of someone who's a net contributor, there will be less appointment slots, yeah, not more. I mean...
Well, we were talking about, before we started recording this episode, we were discussing the NHS salary bans, because this kind of assumption that low paid and unskilled are the same thing. We checked the NHS salary bans. Everybody from a band 2 healthcare assistant, which is the bottom of the pay scale, up to a registrar, they all earn less than £50,000. A registrar earns £47,132. £50,000 is the cutoff. But no, yeah, if you're not earning 50, so effectively, she's just sacked everybody who works for the NHS who is an EU citizen. They're not earning enough. And who will replace them?
But has anyone seen a challenge back to this? It's almost like, well, okay, well, yeah, that's the way it must be then, because, you know, whoever is, yeah, the government of the day have spoken. Well, yeah, where's the challenge? Where's the? Yeah. But you do know this will mean XXX.
Yes, yeah, where is the challenge, Jeremy?
There has been a timidity from politicians of all shades to speak about, yeah, immigration for far, far, far too long, and it has to end.
Not for a podcast that hasn't. One favourite that got trotted out was British people will do low-skilled jobs like social care and hospitality. There are going to be loads of unskilled jobs at the Festival of Brexit Britain. A fine British-made segue for you there. Cast your mind back to the distant days of last Sunday when our Prime Minister announced a special event in 2022 to mark a moment of national renewal. Even though it seems likely that the nation will collapse to the floor, be enveloped in a red, white and blue glow, and change from Jodie Whittaker into William Hartnell in black and white, go back to the early 1960s. Apparently we're going to evoke the spirit of 1951's Festival of Britain and spend £120 million to promote the best of business, art and sport. Somehow. The ironies came thick and fast. The Prime Minister forgot that the Festival of Britain was a response to the uninvited devastation of Britain during the Second World War, and it was a Labour initiative, and the moment Churchill came to power, he ordered the site to be flattened, which seemed a bit Luftwaffe of him, I thought. Alex, you read about this on a flight back from Mykonos and nearly hijacked the plane in a desperate attempt to go home and bid for political asylum. But what did you really think?
I was literally eyeing the emergency exit and clawing at the window.
I think you said you were going to kill yourself with a spork.
I genuinely... Okay, so this is what happened. I genuinely thought it was a joke. Yes. I absolutely thought...
You thought it was a news thumb
really
or
funny.
A Daily Mash headline.
I thought this is really funny. They're circulating this idea to poke fun. And then I saw the actual sort of reputable news sites going that it, yeah, was a thing. It was an actual real thing. And I tried to kill myself with a spork.
Yes, but you didn't succeed, and we're happy about that. Yes. Obviously, this was Christmas come early for Twitter, and you all saw the fun stuff. But where do we think the Festival of Brexit Britain should be held? Where should they hold it? Can't be in Remainer Elite London for a kickoff.
No, it can't.
So it's going to have to be somewhere that voted Leave.
Yeah.
Sunderland, I don't know. Cornwall's nice. Eden Project. Oh, no, funded by the EU. It's going to be very difficult to put this on, I think. Naomi, it's pretty suspicious also that it's the 100th anniversary of the partition of Ireland. So they could hold it in Unionist North Down.
Well,
North Down voted 53 Remain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's suspicious that it's on the 100th anniversary of the partition of Ireland, but it's actually also utterly disrespectful. Mm. You know, it was in 1922 that the Irish Free State finally broke away from British rule, except for the six counties that make up Northern Ireland.
Can you do it in the voice, please?
It was that year that Ireland was divided and the border put in place.
That's better.
It was in that year that a one-party unionist state was formed in Northern Ireland. And it was in that year that discrimination against Catholics living in the six counties was emboldened again. It was in that year that the seeds were sown for the ensuing decades of division, sectarianism and violence. But yes, Teresa, you go ahead and celebrate oppression and division and bloodshed if you want and see where it gets you.
That was marvellous.
I think I love you.
It's like riding a bike, isn't it? You never forget. Hugh and Emma, I mean, what do you think of this? I mean, as...
Not my name.
Here, here.
Well, sorry.
It just seems another sort of example of, you know, the petrol gauge lights on, and rather than address the problem, let's just stick a plaster over it and hope we can do something to distract people.
And it just
seems another example of what can we do to get through the next 48 hours or week of government. Nobody on the ground would say this is a credible idea. And also, there's this conflation of concepts. So, you know, so much people are trying to tie to Brexit. You mentioned homelessness earlier and people saying, oh, but if it wasn't for the, in quotes, immigrants rather than expats, well, they're two different problems. Mm. And everything's when you boil it down, like you said, sort of zero-sum game, it's very easy to simplify this stuff. So if you want to celebrate Britishness, well, isn't that what the British Council are doing already all around the world and supporting people? It's already happening. Global Britain, it's already happening. You know, so, but it's just this... Let's boil it down to a slogan and a badge, and everybody's distracted enough.
But even at the basic level of strategy, you don't announce something that's going to happen in 4 years' time when all manner of things could have occurred. You don't make yourself a hostage to fortune in that way, do you?
I don't know how they sort of market tested this, because she mentioned it in her speech today. That's Wednesday. Hmm. And even people in the hall laughed.
But this reinforces the point, isn't it? That you can almost imagine, I mean, we used to see it on the thick of it and things like this, where we have to have something to announce.
What it's can inflatable we announce? Castles. Inflatable bouncy castles. Yeah. No, inflatable churches for the community. That was what it was, wasn't it? Inflatable.
It's exactly. You know, so it's like, what can we need to announce something big and grand that we don't actually have to do yet and we don't have to fund yet, but something that will get people talking.
But that's, she did say £120 million for it, which, you know, good luck to her raising that.
I don't think it's going to get you much on the grand festival level. I think it probably costs more than that to put Glastonbury on. They've got their own field. Yeah. You know, I kind of war gamed it in my head, and it came out looking, it's going to make the Millennium Dome look like a success. The arts, you haven't got to pray. You're going to get Lee Hurst and Roger Daltrey and John Cleese in a cardboard Downton Abbey.
But they'll all be Remainers by then.
Absolutely. Alive?
Yeah. Sport. Premier League is full of non-UK players. You may be able to sort of frog march a couple of Olympians on board, but highly unlikely. And then you're left with business. So what's that? Our Aaron Banks' car phone warehouse phone zone and an all-you-can-drink Witherspoons with no foreign lager? What, you know...
And send in Dyson to Hoover up the
mess. Absolutely, yeah. It's not really happening, is it? May said, Britain once again stands at the cusp of a new future. As an outward-facing trading nation, we want to showcase what makes our country great today. But this is an inward-facing project, isn't it?
It's just another example. So, you know, my day job is I run projects for customers. And I look at this and it's almost like a customer coming up to me or, you know, presenting a business case. And you think, well, it's based on nothing. So there's no way we're even going to consider this project or fund this project until I understand what it's made up of and what the benefits are. It's basics. And there are no tangible benefits. There's no detail of where you got 120 million from. I don't care if you said it was 500 million or a billion. Yeah. There's nothing to make up the number, so the number is irrelevant.
From her speech today, I think the idea is that you invite loads of Commonwealth dignitaries, basically, to come along.
What, those ones that told us that we shouldn't leave the EU?
Them the ones. And they come along and you put on, you know, some tent with the newest Dyson... Hoover made in Indonesia and tried to sell
robot.
It to them.
Yes.
What do you think of it? It sucks. Yes.
Yeah. Mm. That says everything, doesn't it? Well, that's basically going to be the festival.
What would, as Remainers... Emma, sorry, you were saying.
No, I was just thinking, I'm sure that parties always sound nice. It just, when I think about winter coming up, maybe we could just use some of that money now to help the NHS prepare for the winter crisis we're going to have.
That'd be nice.
Help with social care or help with the homeless.
Mm. As Remainers... What would we like? I'd quite like some show trials, actually. See me in a wig. What? I mean, just trying to be impartial about it. Is there anything can be pulled out of this? It's going to be, or is it just going to be a giant mess? We don't fancy it, do we?
Well, we're going to have a Romaniac stall, surely, Andrew.
We'll do a stall. We'll definitely do a stall with Bunting saying, "We told you so." What should Remainers do instead? on this when this
the Schadenfreude Festival.
I think, and this is a serious suggestion. I think we should do a mass exodus to a European capital on Brexit Day. And
you'll never get back in. It's a really bad idea. You'll be queuing at the borders.
Day trips.
Ten days later.
Mass application for visas early. I think we should do it. This year, Paris. Next year, Bucharest. Go and spend our money in Europe, whatever it'll be worth by then. And actually be outward looking instead of putting up a marquee.
Buy your euros now.
Yeah. Actually, by the way, I did think that this actually is the core of Theresa May's Chequers strategy. It's like, we've got to leave now because I've hired the marquee. I've bought the catering.
Can't cancel it.
I've booked Roger Daltrey. Turns out it's not doing it. We can't cancel now. This is my suspicion.
Who books a marquee for a divorce? I mean, that's a really weird thing to do, isn't it?
Now, we know you enjoy podcasts, so we thought you'd like to hear about another one produced by the team behind Romaniacs. It's called Be There with Dali, and in the spirit of outward-looking European business cooperation, it's brought to you by Dali Loudspeakers, Danish manufacturers of super high-end audio gear with beautiful Scandinavian design. In every episode, I sit down with some of the cream of music journalism to talk about the stories behind great recordings, old and new. Here's a snippet from the new series. This is Kate Hutchinson from The Guardian talking about the remarkable story of Sami Ben Redjeb and his Analog Africa record label. This is a man who built his entire life around his obsession with hard-to-find African records.
Well, he's a real character, Sami, and I can't exactly remember, or I don't know how he discovered that his love of African music, but he really went to superb lengths to go and find a lot of this stuff, including, so I think he went to Senegal, where he was a diving instructor. And then he loved it so much, and then he became a DJ in hotels in order to stay there and to find as much music as he can. And then he was like, how can I enable myself to travel around Africa cheaply and go on these massive record hunts? And he decided the best way to do that would be to be a flight attendant. So he got a job at Lufthansa, and this was right after 9/11. So A, not many people wanted to be flight attendants, and B, he managed to negotiate a deal where he could be part-time. So he was part-time flying across Africa, and then the rest of the week he was going to various countries and sort of finding what he could find.
It's astonishing, isn't it? I love the idea of him sort of getting on plane with his duty-free and a huge rattling bag of cassettes from Africa. Explain what's actually happening on that label, the Analog Africa label, and that kind of world of music, because it has become the kind of undiscovered treasure trove of mad sounds you can't get anywhere else, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the key is that Sami has a certain style. So there are a lot of reissue labels now. It is kind of the thing. And Africa, the continent, as well as the Middle East, is somewhere that's really kind of being mined for as much kind of old stuff as possible. But Sami has a particular ear for, he likes old, weird dance music and synth music.
A bit of Be There with Dali for you there. Search Be There with Dali on your favourite podcast app and get the full show. And subscribe for a new episode every 2 weeks. We're delighted to have Emma Hookey and Hugh Norris from Remainer Now with us today. They are the people that really matter, not fixated obsessives like me and Alex and Naomi. Thanks for coming in. Can you tell us, what was your personal experience of the referendum? Because for a lot of people it was confusing, for a lot of people it was enraging. How did you feel about it as the vote was going down?
I was very 50-50 anyway, and I thought it was very, very frightening. Very much this feeling of you will decide. This is an extremely important thing. You will decide. Just don't read anything from the EU because it's all propaganda. So it felt very difficult to make an impartial choice, and I felt the time frame was so small as well. It was really hard to gauge information for myself, and I must admit I did feel a lot of social pressure towards voting Leave. But again, I can only take responsibility for how I voted. I just would love to have found a way to have gotten better information for myself so I could have judged better.
Mm. You mentioned earlier on that the NHS was a big thing for you. Had you been interested in the EU as an issue before it all blew up in the referendum?
To be honest, I'm still shocked actually that we're in this situation. I honestly thought it would be Remain anyway that would win. Even when I voted Leave, I felt voting Leave doesn't mean I don't love the EU and what it is. It should never have been about that. I don't still get all this hostility towards the EU. I think it's one of those things and it was just so insipid.
So were you quite cross with the government at the time? Was your vote at all a sort of a protest against them failing to deliver for you and your community, or was it purely because, you know, there was, yeah, you just weren't getting good enough information about the benefits of staying in?
To be honest, I just heard so much about you're being oppressed. Don't be afraid of being part, you know, I don't want the EU telling us what to do. It's very much a feeling that was being done. You're going to lose the so many lies. You're going to lose the monarchy. We're going to lose the... And you just think, for goodness sake, we're not getting proper trade deals. Immigration was mentioned, but that was never an issue for me whatsoever, personally.
And what about the bus? Because obviously, you know...
Well, the bus, not being funny, especially when it's on a great big bus and you've got politicians and people from Oakley standing right in front of it, you do tend to believe it might be fairly accurate.
Yeah. Mm.
But you know, nobody would have the gall to tell such a blatant lie.
I know. Yeah. Little do I know.
Yeah. But I think that's kind of part of the... Something that's been talked about so little is the kind of... The really good thing about regular elections is moral hazard. If you lied to me this time, you'll be punished next time, because there is a next time. And what we've had with the referendum is once and for all, next time. Say what you like, whatever you can to get over the line.
Yeah, and then you can't.
Hugh, what was it? Emma was saying that it was the NHS that kind of clinched it for her. What was it that clinched it for you that made you vote and leave in the first place?
Well, firstly, to answer a similar question that you asked Emma, I never even particularly thought about the EU. I wasn't really aware. Certainly, wasn't aware how it benefits our daily lives, you know, but it's behind the scenes on all these things and all the rest of it. So it was never anything particularly on my radar. Travel to Europe regularly. I've got friends in mainland Europe. I work in mainland Europe. So initially I just thought, what's this about? Why do we need to do this? And then I thought, well, listen, you know, I can sense this is important. I better go and do as much as I can. And I took it seriously, you know, so, and I thought, well, they're saying, you know, this is an important vote. So I tried to be as open as I could and try and find out as much as I could. But what tipped me, I think, was probably just a combination of things. So the Remain campaign, I know it's been well sort of said now, inspired me to not one jot. It was just fear. And it was fear. That's how I felt. I mean, when I saw people like George Osborne saying, oh, you know, if you vote leave, there's an emergency budget the next day. I saw that interview and I thought, that's just not credible. Nobody just jumps into an emergency budget. And I felt that some of the people who were proposing to remain, it felt to me that the whole campaign was better the devil you know, rather than there are really good benefits. You know, actually, it was classic. I'm a classic. You don't know what you've got till it's gone, which is why I'm fighting, because I don't want it to be gone. It could have been so much more positive, and actually saying remain, you know, should have been a very easy sell in hindsight, because I know a lot more. And what clinched me in the end, similar to Emma, very 50-50, looking back, it should never even been a vote. You know, it's such an obvious thing to want to keep all these benefits. But at the time, I watched one of the big accusations of people, Remain and now people, why didn't you do your homework? And that really makes me cross, because on the... You know, the couple of months or so running up to the vote, I mean, I wouldn't like to guess how many hours and hours of documentaries and reports and everything I read. I didn't use social media at the time, so I wasn't affected by the likes of Facebook and everything. I didn't use it. And I watched hours and hours and hours of this stuff, and I came out thinking, seems much of a muchness to me. And you've got people saying, just stick with what you've got, and they didn't really explain what that was, from what I saw. And then you had others saying, I didn't believe the outrageous lie, so forget the Farages of the world. But the others were saying, we can keep these benefits and have more. Mm. And when it actually came to the booth, I thought, well, we might not get this chance again. And they're saying that we can do the exact same benefits. Everybody remembers the lovely line, so nobody was talking about, you know, removing rights and everything. And we can have more trade. And instead of having a centralised pot of money giving to this body, we can distribute it to the regions and we can do all of this stuff. Mm. But the whole debate made me think, well, it seems 50-50. So what I'll do is I'll... And also I knew it was advisory, by the way. I did know that. So it seems 50-50. So let's give them a chance, was my view. Let's see, you know, because what if... They don't get this chance again, and we're saying we could actually have better public services and better trade, and we can do even more, plus keep the same benefits. So for me, it was I'm going to give you a chance. Mm. For that to be interpreted the way it has, I have never felt so played in my life.
Right.
That's what made me furious. They've run away from everything that they said that was potentially possible. And I would just never have believed that any kind of UK government, however it would have ended up, it would have ended up some kind of pretty sensible deal, and everything would have been fine. And it wouldn't have really affected anybody. And for us to be going down the road we're going down, even if somebody said that to me, this is exactly what's going to happen, any colour of any party, I would never believe the UK government. So actually, when it came to the end of the day, when it came to the vote, it was 50-50. Somebody, the Remain campaign, just didn't really sell me any benefits. And the other one, I thought, well, let's give you a chance. I was played.
And how, that's why I'm angry. And how soon did you feel played? Like, do you remember the moment, or was it sort of a slow drift? Or, you know, how instant was it that you were like, oh, you know, they lied to us?
The slow drift. So I was surprised on the morning. And then the slow drift, as I said, was more about when I started seeing people really being affected, and I started seeing xenophobia.
Right.
And then it became, oh my God, what have I done? I didn't realise this was a proxy.
Xenophobia was pretty instant, actually, you know, the attacks on Eastern Europeans in particular.
And then we're coming out of markets and everything else. That's when I realised.
Hmm. For me, it was that morning after, and you had Mr Farage on Good Morning Britain going insane about the mistake, about that pledge with the bus.
Yes.
And I thought, what?
Yeah.
And then we had the xenophobia attacks, and I was like,
we shouldn't have said that. Yeah.
Why the heck have you, you say, we were played.
Well, I suppose this kind of introduces the notion of fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And that's why we are being denied so far a chance to have a second look at it, because people are wise to it now. Mm. We on this podcast have kind of been, in a lot of ways, kind of trapped in this kind of window of how do you persuade people when the allegiance to their decision is emotional rather than reason-based. How do you persuade people to your position? You've got the kind of bona fides of being able to say, look, I was you. I agreed with what you agree with now, but I've changed my mind. What do you find are the best ways to argue people around?
Keeping an open mind, keeping a kind heart. Skiz cartoons have been fantastic, actually, with my parents. It was really funny because I got the book with all the cartoons in, and they had a look at it, and I went, go and have a look, because they're very proud of it. They still would like to be, but they're a lot more open-minded now. And we laughed over it, and I said, because there is wit to it, but there is actually some truth, isn't
which,
there?
Which cartoons are these?
Skiz cartoons. They're in the New European.
Right, okay. Yeah. Hugh, are there things that you kind of... Because you're, like, quite... You know, you're both... thickly involved in Remainer now. What works?
The best reactions I've had in terms of people actually wanting to have the discussion is when I just tell them up front I voted Leave and I've changed my mind. I found that as you know, when I've not done that many, but when I've done street stalls, and you know, people see me standing in front of the European flag now and things like that, I've literally been on street stalls where members of the public who voted Leave are railing at somebody next to me. And when I've said to them, "Oh, can I have a word?" and my opening line has been, "I know this might surprise you, but I voted Leave too, and let me explain why I voted Leave and why I'm here today."
Yeah.
And it seems that the aggression then stops. Oh, okay. So this isn't an aggressive.
Yeah, you're not calling them stupid.
Yeah, I'm not saying you're wrong and I'm right.
It's not loaded with all that stuff.
And what I found is I personally don't expect in a conversation to change somebody's mind. But what I want to try and do, and I found Femi Oliwale to be fantastic. I've just sort of, oh God, that's a great fact. That's a great fact.
Yeah.
So a classic conversation I've had, for example, on a street stall was with this person who voted Leave and was having a go at, you know, another colleague on the street stall, said, can I just explain why I voted Leave? You know, and I was sort of in my own way paraphrasing some of Femi's points. Wouldn't it be great just to be able to make one version of a product? Wouldn't it be great that, and they agree with these points. Wouldn't it be great if you know people coming into the country had to be self-sufficient? We know all the points, you know, Article 2, whatever it is, Article 7. But I didn't phrase it like that. And they said, yeah. And I said, well, this is what I learned since I voted. That was always the case. You know, I mean, for me, it wasn't immigration, but it's irrelevant. But, you know, whatever points I want to make. But when I explain why I voted Leave, and they kind of understand, and a lot of that rings true to them. And then I explain, I've subsequently found out that actually this isn't the case and that's not the case. So I said, all I want to do is have another vote. Because now for me, I've changed my mind. For you, you may not change your mind, but we know a lot more. So all I'm saying is maybe we can meet in the middle and say, well, we should vote again, because you may also not get what you're voting for. So personally, I want people to change their mind, but I don't expect it's realistic to say on the basis of a conversation or two that they're going to change their mind. But what they will do, from my experience, is the hostility drops and they listen and they go away and you can see their brain ticking over. And I hope that eventually, you know, gets them to think. And some people have. Some people have said, yeah, actually, I have changed.
Yeah.
Hugh, you said earlier that you were disappointed, or you sort of didn't believe all of the Project Fear stuff. And those of us that are sort of thinking about how we would campaign again, you know, if we do get the chance to do so in a people's vote, you know, there are still people within the movement that agitate for that, saying, well, no, actually, Project Fear does work. We just didn't do enough of it. And what would your reaction be to that? Because from everything I've heard from Leavers is that wouldn't work.
Emma's shaking her head enormously. Yeah.
It wouldn't work. For me, it's I've gone from, and I can't believe I'm, you know, alone here, but I've gone from thinking, wasn't really aware of the EU, to be honest, you know, before 2016, kind of knew it was some political body and it didn't really come into my life much, as I thought. Sell the benefits.
Yeah.
I have learned so much in the last 2 years.
It's just a very positive campaign.
Sell the sunlit uplands are what we've already got. So, yeah, you know, sell them. Because we're walking away from all these benefits, or potentially walking away from all these benefits. That's all we need to do. Even the term Remain isn't that helpful. It's like, well, stick what you got. But sell the benefits. I personally think Project Fear is, I don't think you're ever going to get somebody to say, do you know what, you were right and I was wrong. Just sell the benefits and say, yeah, wouldn't it be great if you could have all this? Yes, it would.
Emma?
If you're able to take the pressure off, and just, to me, one of the big things that's also helped me is just the compassion everyone has. Being part of Remain and out, meeting other people, that understanding is just priceless. Mm. And to me also, there are a lot of benefits, and also just explaining people's lives and hearing their stories. Who wouldn't want to protect that?
At Best of Britain, we've worked with Hope Not Hate, which is an anti-racism group, but just its very name, I think, sums up the campaigning tactic that you're advocating. You give people the hope, sell the positive vision of it, and with them we've identified that not only have we got two of you in the room, but there are actually 3.6 million people who have switched their vote from Leave to Remain. There have been a million that have shifted the other way, but that does mean that it nets out at well over 2 million. And that means that 112 constituencies now have also switched, meaning that the majority of constituencies in the country do now back Remain. So that is good news for your cause.
Yeah. Sounds like we should have had these guys doing the podcast since the start, instead of us moaning.
I find it interesting that what comes through from both of you is that the effect of the dire warnings was to actually make voting Leave feel like the braver choice.
Yeah.
And who doesn't want to be brave, ultimately?
I don't. You know? I'm a coward.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I get that not just from you, but from a lot of people who voted Leave that I talked to, that it felt like a dare. It felt like the mainstream, the government and everything behind the Remain campaign was daring people to do something.
And next time round, the status quo would be the government of the day. So
well,
it would hopefully have,
you know,
a totally different culture too.
There's been two years since then, and I think everyone has learned a lot. If I were going into the campaign now, if I could turn back time, I think my strategy would be challenging people on the detail, because I think that's where they fall down. You ask Boris Johnson, you know, 2 years ago at that debate when he declared that he was, you know, what are your plans for aviation? Explain to me, what are your plans for medicine?
If I could turn back time. Thank you. Thank you, Cher.
Yes.
And that brings us to the end of the show, which means time for the Brexit time capsule. Emma and Hugh, you're the guests, so you get to choose something to go into our Raiders of the Lost Ark storage chamber of things we'll miss if we leave the EU.
For me, for the time capsule, it would be free movement.
You're not the first person to say that. It seems to be the thing that people are. I mean, certainly in my case, it just infuriates me, the idea that somebody's going to go papers, please, or that I'm going to have to do an Esther.
Yeah, absolutely. And people, you know, see that now. I mean, this week, perfect example, this week, went to see, and you sort of think, well, are you sure you voted Leave? You know, and I promise you I did. But this week, case in point, met my two close German friends for a weekend in Lisbon.
Mm.
Just like that. Went on a Friday, had the weekend, came back on Sunday evening. Why? And people say, yeah, well, you can do that anyway on holiday. But roll that out on a million other examples of business and leisure and just experiencing culture. And it's a very closed shop. You know, it will close people's horizons and everything. And not only are we potentially going to lose that, But we've also got a government who's celebrating the fact that we're going to lose that. I don't get it.
Yeah. Emma, what would you like to put in the Brexit time capsule?
People feeling safe and secure. People, families. No one should be in limbo. Shouldn't have happened before. Shouldn't be happening now. Promises have already been broken. It should be no question. We're all equal. It's our home together. And I mean that. And I don't care how long it takes. I'm going to be standing with everyone. How it should be. That's what family does. You protect each other.
Yeah. All right. So naturally, we're going to finish the show with a clip in a non-English EU language. And this, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly here, this is Miklós Gyalog with some Hungarian.
Üdvözlet a reményiek hallgatóinak Magyarországról, az Európai Unió másik végéről. Élvezzük a hátralévő néhány hónapot, amíg ugyanannak a közösségnek lehetünk tagjai, míg aztán az Egyesült Királyság kilép, Magyarországot megkirúgják.
So Magyars Devavam, that means greetings to the listeners of Romaniacs from Hungary. You stop. The other end, Miklós said, that means greetings to the listeners of Romaniacs from Hungary, the other end of the European Union. Let's enjoy the remaining few months while we are members of the same community until the United Kingdom leaves and Hungary is kicked out. Miklós, we're sure that's not going to happen and we are here for you. There is a spare bed here. So listeners, do send us your closing clip in a European language. If you like, just record something on your phone and email it with a translation to info@romaniacs.com and we'll use the best ones. And that is the end of the show. Thanks to our special guests, Emma Hookey and Hugh Norris of Remainer Now. Keep up the good work. We'll see you at the demo on the 20th of October then, shall we?
Yeah, we'll be there with other Remainer Now.
Yes. And is there going to be a gigantic big Remainer Now banner?
There is going to be a banner, yes. And some others, some
we've
more Remainer Now.
We'll, events,
we'll congregating beforehand and marching together.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay. Mm-hmm. Listeners, don't forget, you can get every episode of Romaniacs a day early if you back us on the Patreon crowdfunding platform, plus smart T-shirts, mugs, and a weekly column by one of our panellists. Alex, I think it's your turn next week, so better
it'll
get thinking.
It'll be a cracker.
It'll be a belter. Just search Patreon Romaniacs to find out more, or it's at the top of the Romaniacs Facebook page. One sad bit of news, our brilliant producer Jack Claremont has gone and got a proper job in Brexit Britain of all places, so he's going to be leaving us. In fact, he's producing this one from home. So Jack, if you're listening, and I hope you are listening, because otherwise how are you going to edit the show? Thanks for all your hard work. We know you're going to go on to great things, and don't forget us when you're a major figure in big podcast. And on that sad note, goodbye, and we'll see you next time. But first, here's our theme tune, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a salute to our latest Patreon backers.
Big thanks from me to Neil Brooks, Agnieszka Mateszko, Dan Swan, David Prosser, Tom Freeman, and Robert Pierce.
Thanks from me to Nicholas Cobby, William Copley, Ben Whitelaw, the mysterious Simon, and Siobhan McCluskey.
And hello from me to John Ferrier, Dominic Legazma, Paula Wilcox from Man About the House, I do hope so, Oliver Gray, Gordon Robison, and Russell Lazenby. Many thanks, and we'll see you all next week.
Romaniacs was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison with Naomi Smith and me, Alex Andreu. Audio production was by Jack Claremont, whom we are going to miss very much. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.